This kid's got great stuff.
How many strikeouts?
What's it all about?
I gotta
switch
Why
are
app.
We here?
Hold on.
Is
What's
there
this
a
kid's
God?
ERA?
What happened?
173?
How about I get left?
In this
288?
What's going on? I can hear you with the video stuff. I just have to switch back.
Like me,
we gotta pull the trigger on this kid.
All right, I'll go talk to his agent.
But all of them.
Well, are we
times
looking?
Think
I think he's in talks with another team.
Of life. Hello, welcome. Thank you for joining us again. Our guest this time is Bono. And thank you, sir, for giving us your time. It just occurs to me at this moment that I am greeting the product of what used to be known in Ireland at that time as a mixed marriage. Iris Rankin, your mother, Protestant, married to Bob Hewson, Catholic, your father.
It's hard to imagine it being unusual now, isn't it?
Incredible. So anachronistic, extraordinary.
Yeah. There are a lot more interesting marriages going on now than Catholic and Protestant. But I guess in the 60s, 70s in Ireland, that was pretty extraordinary. And if I'm honest, I think we did feel it was a bit different. And it was odd to have my father drop us off, my brother and I, with my mother at a little Church of Ireland church, St. Canice's in Finglas, and not come in with us. And then be waiting there for us when we came out. And even though later in my life I would feel equally at home or not at home in a Catholic or Protestant church or any church, I started out with that sort of Church of Ireland point of view, and that was because my father thought my mother would be doing the raising in that regard, so he should honour that.
Were fingers pointed at you? Were you made to feel any remarks or anything like that?
No, I don't really remember that. But I think the effect it had in the house was that religion was a subject that was handled a little differently. So it was an uneasy thing for them, but they made it very easy for us. And though my father loved and appreciated faith as it grew in me, he grew out of his, which was interesting. And so towards the end of life, he lost it. Didn't want me to, but he did.
Do you have a sense that at some stage he regretted not seeing to it that you were brought up Catholic? That
no, I don't think so. As I think the whole country came out from under a spell. He was one of the first people to wake up to this rather ridiculous family argument in the Christian family. Of course, these things were made more vivid by the troubles in the north and sectarianism, but I think everyone was waking up to the fact that that religion was probably the enemy of God, and that God was a bigger subject than religion.
Meanwhile, round about 14, your grandfather died, and then almost immediately your mother died suddenly.
Interesting. Yeah, my mother died at her own father's funeral, right at the side of the grave, which I guess is an unusual way to go. It took her a few days later. She had a stroke. So it was a few days later when eventually we gathered around a bed in, I think, the Mater Hospital and sort of said goodbye to her.
So now you're 14 and your dad is left with you and your big brother Norman.
Mm-hmm.
How did we all cope with that? Can you remember? Well or not?
Irish males are a piece of work, are they not? And, I'm sure it was very difficult for my father. I was enter chaos. And then you have your big tantrum, don't you, with God and the universe, because, you know, you're 14, you just come out of puberty, and you don't know why you feel the way you feel. You have some rage, let's put it like that. And they had to live with that.
The parallels with Bob Geldof are amazing. He was left alone with his father, who was away most of the week, unlike your father, and his two sisters.
I'd wish my dad would be away all the week. I'm sure.
So you're at loggerheads with Dad.
Yeah, but it's my fault. And I realized that later in life, in quite an epiphany. And I realized that, you know, he was really doing his best.
So then Mount Temple, co-ed, non-denominational.
Yeah, it was just this extraordinary oasis in education in Ireland. You know, guess what? It's co-educational. We have boys and girls. Great. There's no religion in the formal sense. Great. And later when we joined a band, they kind of moved things around even for us then. Couldn't have been better.
Lipton Village, Googie, Gavin Friday, sort of, what was all that about? Was that a secret society or a club or a Masonic lodge or something?
On Cedarwood Road, Cedarwood Road is a great street, little quiet enclave in the suburbs, Cedarwood Estate, really. But in the back garden, eventually, they build the Seven Towers, the Ballymun Flats. Amazing. Modernization comes to Ireland in the form of these things. And you had Finglas down the road. There was a lot of violence about in our teenage years. And you had to be very careful where you went. And we developed a kind of defense mechanism of humor. We kind of invented a whole sort of street gang.
How many are in this we now?
I don't know. I mean, it was at the very heart of it was myself and my still best friend, Googie, who's an extraordinary painter, as you know. And it's Googie that gives me my name, Bono, which is short for Bonavox of O'Connell Street. And I wouldn't even ask about that because it's like, who could explain?
So we dreamed up these names for each other.
Yeah.
And somehow or another, they were along the lines of what the fella looked like.
Got it. That's right. They had to express the visual sort of characteristics, of visually characteristics, had to express sort of the personality. So then when Edge got his, although his original name was Inchicore, which is really, can you imagine if I was introducing him now? Inchicore! I mean, every Inchicore would be up for it. But it was just, you know, Larry's, it was Jam Jar. There was a little bitty one-way street. Googie was particularly gifted in the art of name-giving, and he still is. But it's creating your own world. And being different in the 70s in the suburbs was a punishable crime. And there was a lot of aggression directed towards us. And then when we got to know Gavin Friday up the road, Finnon Hanvey had been his name, and he was the most outrageously dressed of us all. He was just consistently beaten the shit out of. And of course, it just made him worse. He just dressed him. But humor was the revenge. I mean, Gavin would be walking down Cedarwood Road and, you know, in a dress with bobber boots and, you know, 6-inch high hair, like David Lynch's Eraserhead, and his father, Pascal, who looked like Elvis, would literally cross the street. And I remember Googie calling to pick me up as a kid. My dad, shaving in the kitchen, goes out, opens the door, and Googie's on a horse.
Just on a horse?
There. Yeah. That's the kind of humor I'm talking about. Now that I look back on it, some of the violence that was directed to us, we probably deserved, because we might have been a bit arrogant. And I know that I can certainly, when I look my most smug, I'm usually my most nervous. It's like a tick. But it was really our defense mechanism, you know.
Okay, now let me move on to Ali. Ali Stewart, at what stage did she come on the scene and what effect did she have? And tell me all about that.
Well, you know, I dated Ali the week I joined U2. That was a very good week for me. You know, I had seen her as a kid, you know, when she arrived in Mount Temple. She had a very special way about her. She's completely unself-conscious. I thought the most beautiful girl I'd ever seen, but she wore like Wellington boots, tartan skirt, and a jumper her mother made for her. She just looked elegant in anything she wore, but she didn't think about what she wore. And she was very bright. I mean, I think she was in the same year as Edge. The two of them were the smartest people, you know, at the top of their class. And I was a year ahead of them. And at one point, I remember just seeing her. I was going out on the back of somebody's motorbike. I was leaving Men Temple. And I saw her crossing the school yard. And I just, something just happened inside of me. And I just saw her as just this very special presence that I just needed to hold on to and never let go kind of thing. So that's what happened.
That was it.
Yeah, I went after. I mean, it was hard work to
was she resistant?
To get to go out. Yes, she still is.
How long did it take?
Minutes. No, I don't know. It took. I mean, I was at it for years, really. In fact, she did brush me off quite seriously, and it was a friend of hers. Now that I think about it, what was his name? Who, after she had turned me down on the first date, said to me, "I think you should try again." And I said, "Well, what's the point?" And he said, I think you should try again. I think there's something there.
It's just the game going on. Now, I don't want to go through the early days of you two all over again and practicing in the kitchen and in the garage and all of that. But it seems
still
to me
you were
setting up a Christian rock and roll band. Now, if ever there was a kiss of death on any enterprise, that had to be it.
No, it wasn't really like that, though. Remember, when we started out, it was punk rock was breaking out. And we connected with those kind of art rock groups. You know, we didn't start, did not start the band to say, go save the world. We started the band to go save our own ass, you know, and try and impress people like Ali Stewart.
Quite, yeah. But then Dave Fanning paints a picture of you reading the Bible in the bus and the Shalom Fellowship.
Yeah.
What was that?
Well, there was a... there are revivals. You've probably, I mean, you read about them, and it's just people are moved. And at that time, 76, 77, a lot of things were happening. You had Bob Dylan's conversion to Christianity, so something was stirring. Let's put it that way, and it was happening in Mount Temple a little bit, and then. Whilst we were on this kind of Lipton Village, surreal, gangbanging trip, we bump into some people who seem to have a real, you know, deep faith. And there was a fellow called Chris Rowe who ran a Christian meeting called Shalom. And this fellow really understood the scriptures. And he could really unlock them. And I'd always been fascinated by the scriptures. I mean, you can't be a fan of the blues or you can't be a fan of Bob Dylan or folk music and not really understand the scriptures a bit. So we became very interested in this. And they, at first, appeared to appreciate that we were different and didn't want us to change the way we looked. But then it started to dawn on us that in the end they thought that rock and roll was a kind of a distraction from what was really going on in a broken world. And it sort of crescendoed with Edge leaving the band. It was Edge and me, but he said to me, you know, it's right, you know, there's really... The world is a broken place, and there's a lot of broken lives, and this is really not the way to go about anything useful with our life, you know. And so we both left the band. So we've already now had our first album is out. It's done very well in the US and elsewhere. Got a big tour. We then go and see Paul McGuinness, the Winston Churchill of Rook. And he's sitting there and ready to meet them on the beaches. And and we say, Paul, we're not, you know, we're done. And actually want to do something useful with our life. And maybe rock and roll isn't it. And blah, blah, blah. And he's like, oh, so God tells you to do this. And we said, no, it's not exactly, but it's very deeply convicted here. He said, would you mind speaking to God about like the commitments I've made on your behalf to do another tour? Because I presume that, you know, breaking your contract wouldn't be a, you know...
In accordance with God.
Wouldn't be in accordance with... So we kind of go, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Okay, just one more tour. And so this is on our second album, October, and we do that tour for that album. And then we start to write, and Edge actually starts writing the song Sunday Bloody Sunday. And kind of came at that moment. And whatever happened, somehow we started to realize that our music was the way that we spoke to the world. Our music, these were prayers of a kind. And what were we doing hanging out with these people who didn't understand this? They'd somehow turned God into a very retail relationship, you know? And you had to, you know, declare it. It had to be something, had to have a Christian sticker on it. I don't understand that. You know, does a tree have a sign up saying, made by God? No, it's just... It's there. It declares itself. The creation does. So music does. Poetry does. And more importantly, the problem with gospel music is a lot of the time it's in denial of where we're really at. A lot of the time it's trying to brush things under the carpet, which is where the blues comes from. The blues, Robert Johnson, hellhound on my heel, starts to speak the truth. Now, if you know anything about the scriptures, you know it's the truth that sets you free. So we started to see the sort of the lies, and maybe that's too strong a term, that was in gospel music and all this kind of happy clappy stuff. And we started to see that actually the truthfulness of the blues, and of course rock and roll is the combination of the blues and gospel, the highness, the headiness of gospel, and the mud of the Mississippi, of Delta, or indeed the Liffey, or the Mersey, or whatever it is. That's where the mud. And that is where our music really comes from. That moment, that's the fusion, really.
Okay, moving on to 1984, and Bob Geldof comes along and says, Band Aid, Live Aid, and you participate. How big a marking point was that? And it would have been in accordance with the track you're already on.
Right. That's true. So, we were part of what you might call some kind of positive protest music, you know. And it's funny because the Boomtown Rats couldn't be on a more different tack. Mm-hmm. You know, looking after number one and all of that. So I thought it was rather odd when to get a call from Bob Geldof saying, we have to do something about this famine in Ethiopia. And I was like, well, yeah, I think you're right. And I do think God has a great sense of humor to have Bob in charge of this. Firstly, because he doesn't believe in God.
And anything.
Which I love. But surely I can tell you God believes in him. And also, you know, Bob is not famous for throwing it around. You know, the band will tell you. You know, he's frugal. So the idea that this instrument of peace would be Bob Geldof is just one of the most beautiful ironies. It's a divine comedy. And here's a man who profoundly changed things.
Profoundly.
In Ethiopia and in the activism that grew in the UK in particular. And indeed me. And afterwards, then we go, myself and Ali go, and we were like a month and a bit in Ethiopia, just under the wire, no cameras. And that changes our life.
Everything.
So
everything.
I owe Bob big time and for turning my life upside down or right side up, depending on the way you see it.
I can understand that took you into the whole area that you've been working on for so long now, and I can understand that the need of W and Bill Clinton and Tony Blair to be seen photographed with you. But did you ever think, mixing with any of these people, that you were supping with the devil?
You know, I just had one idea, really, when it came to activism, which is, don't let it be a creation of the left. Don't leave the right out. In terms of the political spectrum, try to find a radical center. Because why divide the audience in half? So when I go and see an economist when we're doing Drop the Debt, I'd ask to see a conservative economist as well as I'd want a liberal one. I was very happy to spend time with George Bush, as I am with, say, President Hollande of France, or
various
popes,
high
presidents,
popes and presidents. And all.
But the Pope came out.
Did you ever? As the Pope gave you that?
John Paul II, when we went to see him with Bob.
Yeah.
And
that's the
actual one he gave me. Yeah. It's called the Crooked Cross. It's Michelangelo designed. It's a miniature of the one that he brought around, designed by Michelangelo.
And that's worn 24/7.
Beat that guy.
And yet, isn't it wonderful the effect meeting the Pope has on one?
Yeah. He really did.
Did he really?
He did move me. And, you know, there was... Bob was very keen on his loafers. He was wearing oxblood. He thought they were, I think, Gucci loafers or Prada. He'd know those kinds of things. But Quincy Jones, who was the other side of us, said, after he left, he said, man, they were pimp shoes. I said, Quincy, you should not say that. And he wore my glasses. He put my glasses on. I had seen him staring at me, and I thought, is this some sort of messianic complex? I mean, more than normal. And so I took my glasses off, you see, and I just had them like that. I thought maybe he thought it was disrespectful.
Quite.
And then as I walked up to meet him, I said, maybe he wants these. So I gave him, I said, would you like these, Your Holiness? And he got them and he put them on, you see. They were blue. And he made this wicked, mad, wicked smile. And of course, the cameras went, and I went, brilliant. We'll be on the cover of every newspaper with Drop the Debt campaign. This is fantastic. And Dearwood Martin, now the Archbishop here in this city, was the Minister of Faith and Justice. We went, this is fantastic. He said, you will never see those photographs, ever. And he could see the T-shirts. But actually, after...
What a pity.
But after John Paul died, the picture got out. One of the Vatican photographers left it out.
Again, getting back to, instead of attacking them or haranguing them or shouting at them or making them feel bad, even the worst of them, there's good somewhere. Am I searching here?
No.
No.
No, I feel when I go to meet particularly a head of state and people ask me if I'm nervous, I always say, no, I'm not. They should be, because they will be held to account for the decisions they made in office. And if those decisions affect millions and millions of people who live in far off places, but who really could have their lives transformed by a good decision, they don't make it. I believe it should weigh heavily on them. And I've met so many heads of state now who, when they leave office, say to me, I wish you had harangued me even more. Bill Clinton, who's, you know, my hero, he led on debt cancellation, and he's right out in front in the fight against AIDS since he left office. But it's a real deep regret of his that he didn't do more on the AIDS pandemic while he was in office.
So the strategy is, don't antagonize them and don't harangue them. Win them over.
And oh, no, do antagonize.
Well, don't fling mud at them from the rooftops.
Don't take the obvious route. And understand when you go to a meeting that the meeting will be longer if you can solve their problems for them. So when George Bush's heart wanted to respond to the AIDS emergency, but there wasn't much support on the right, particularly religious support, strangely, You would think that AIDS would remind people of the leprosy they read about in the scriptures, but it didn't. And evangelical Christians at that time, they weren't responding. Now, getting support for President Bush on his right, going to see Rupert Murdoch, speaking to Rupert Murdoch about that, was part of our strategy in making it possible for President Bush to do what he did. And you have to say this, it's the largest ever amassing of resources against a single disease in the history of the planet that he led. And we were part of that and part of getting him there. But it is a remarkable thing. There's 8 million people now on antiretroviral drugs, largely paid for by the United States of America. God bless America.
God bless America again. So a quick précis then, well nigh 30 years after Live Aid and Bob Geldof and this turning point in your life, a quick précis of how has the world improved?
Well, on this, it's remarkable. And really quickly, the great indicator is infant mortality under fives, and in 20 years there are 7,000. Let me get this right. 7,256. I love the little numbers. 7,256 less kids under five dying every day.
Every day.
Think about that, and. These are figures released by the World Bank, World Health Organization. You can plot this, and you can plot it going forward. So if we keep doing what we know how to do, vaccinating young kids against pneumococcal, rotavirus, names you can't even pronounce, but they're killers. Biggest problem, biggest killer of all, it's not a disease, it's not HIV, it's not malaria, it's corruption. But we have a vaccine for that too. It's called daylight. It's called transparency. So what we're working on now at the One Campaign is pushing transparency legislation. So I'd be very optimistic, very, very optimistic. Even indeed by 2030, it is possible if people hold tight to their aid commitments, and Ireland is, what an heroic thing, broadly support, 80% of Irish people are behind the Irish aid commitment. If we all keep concentrating, the sort of obscenity of those pictures that inspired Bob Geldof to put on Live Aid, you won't have to see them again, and that it gives me incredible faith in people and incredible gratitude to God.
To God.
Yeah.
If I don't ask you this, I would be criticized. And if I do ask you this, I would be criticized. But since you've touched on the subject now, the subject of U2's taxation arrangements, whereby people are expressing their wonder at what they call your hypocrisy, not my word, their word, hypocrisy of haranguing us all and asking us to pay more for international aid at the same time as you shift your company overseas in order to save taxation.
Yeah, but it's very hard for Irish people to be critical about this because the shock horror moment here is you two behaving like a business. And, I mean, we live in a small rock in the North Atlantic and we would be underwater were it not for very clever people working in government and in the revenue who made tax competitiveness a central part of Irish economic life. And is the reason why we have companies like Google or Facebook, and indeed I helped bring those companies to Ireland. So it's more than churlish for Irish people to say, well, we don't want an Irish company involved in that stuff that we do want everyone else. I mean, we do pay a lot, we pay a lot of tax. But we are, tax sensible, but as every business is. And why is it because I'm involved in these, some people think as idealistic things, but I think as very pragmatic things. Why can't you two be tough in business? This thing of the warm, fuzzy feeling, we want, this. I'd like people to get over that because that's not who I am. I am tough. And I may have you know, I may sing from a very private and intimate place, and I make art, but I'm tough-minded and I'm intellectually rigorous, I hope. And I think you two's tax business is our own business, and I think it's not just in the to the letter of the law, is to the spirit of the law.
In that context, do you feel that you are removed from the ordinary everyday lives of people in Ireland, especially today?
That must be true. I mean, I think all of us who live in the Northern Hemisphere and the Western world probably live incredible lives as far as the world's poor are concerned, but I have to accept that mine is different. And in Ireland, especially at this moment, when really people are hurting so badly and are being deeply affected by problems they had no part in creating. And I'm amazed at the intelligence of the Irish people, actually, in figuring a way out through this, because they could be out on the streets and torching the place, and you'd have to be sympathetic. But they're being smarter than that and realizing we have to attract jobs. We have to get through this, and I think it's heroic, actually. And you know, my kids go to a regular school, a non-fee-paying school. I don't think of myself removed, but to answer your question, I probably must be.
All right, we'll stop there. Join us after this short break.